You're listening to the Berkshire Hathaway Annual Shareholders Meeting Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Yahoo Finance.
Not all cases by a long shot, but in some cases we have managers that will occasionally come up with something that can be quite attractive. But between Greg and Todd and Ted, we've got three extraordinarily good minds in terms of allocating capital. And you know, we may get an occasional call because of someone we knew 20 years ago or something, but they know a lot more people. They've got a lot more energy, and their minds work the same way as ours have in the past. So I think it could very well be a significant improvement when the three of them are thinking about capital allocation than when Charlie and I are now, and particularly now that he's found Zoom.
All right, this next question comes from Max Rudolph in Omaha, Nebraska, and he asks if Berkshire or any of its fully owned businesses have participated in any of the bailouts from the Fed or the Treasury.
I certainly don't know of any. I guess you could say while we own the airlines, the question's about fully owned businesses. And there's no way that I wouldn't know about anybody that did any of that. And Greg?
No. In fact, we've been very clear with the businesses, but our businesses understood how Berkshire operates, and equally we're very clear that we would not be participating in any of those programs or quote bailouts.
This is a similarly related question. It comes from Seth Frieden, who says, as a long-term shareholder of Berkshire B shares, would like to know Warren's viewpoint around smaller holdings, specifically Oriental Trading Company and Nebraska Furniture Mart, that are based in your hometown of Omaha. He imagines that those smaller business units have been adversely impacted by COVID shelter-in-place mandates. So would like to know if Oriental Trading or other small business units applied for PPP loans or participated in those acts, and if they didn't qualify for a loan or didn't participate, then how will Berkshire support those smaller businesses to make sure that they can continue to employ their employees?
Yeah, well, to my knowledge, none of them have gone in for government money, and the two that are mentioned, I don't like to get into specific companies, but I can assure you that the Nebraska Furniture Mart and Oriental Trading, in my view, have a fine future. But I don't want to talk about, go down the list, obviously, of every single company, because some of them I don't know the answer to. We actually decided some time ago that our newspapers would have a much better chance of surviving if they were run as part of Lee than if we ran them independently. And as I said earlier, we actually put considerably more money, we probably put more money in the newspaper business than virtually anybody in the country in the last 6 months, because we took over a loan that would have been a problem in the year, whatever it might have been, maybe a year and a half. And we enable them to just deal with one lender rather than a group. And they are doing a better job with the newspapers than we would do. And that's always our preference. If we've got a business that does not have, looks like it is not going to sustain itself over time in our hands, if we can find somebody else that we think will do a better job, we'd love to have them run it. So if we have a problem business, we would prefer to find somebody that thinks they can do a better job and probably can do a better job of running it than we can. But some businesses just disappear. We started with the textile business. We started a company called Diversified Retailing, which merged into Berkshire, became part of Berkshire, and It started with a department store in Baltimore. And department stores looked good in 1966, but the world has gone against them. And we had a trading stamp business at one time, and we stayed longer than anybody else. But you know, the world left trading stamps behind, and that's going to happen with some businesses. That's capitalism. And it will happen to some Berkshire businesses over the next 10 years and the next 50 years. We think we'll find more of them that will grow and net that Berkshire will grow. But we do not think, if you own a great many businesses, that everyone is destined for success. That's why I suggest to people they buy an index fund. I do not, with the exception of Berkshire, I would not want to put all my money in any one company, although there's a few I wouldn't mind being very close to that. But I don't think, you know, you get surprises in this world, and there will be businesses that we think are very good that turn out not to be so good. And there will be other businesses that turn out better than we think. And it's up to the world to judge our batting average over time.
Greg, yeah.
Well, I would just add and echo again that when it comes to the PPP loans, we're not aware of any of our businesses taking them. And you know, as I said, we encouraged them if they were ever thinking that there was going to be a dialogue, and we're not aware of any businesses pursuing them. I would also just add that when you look at our businesses as we went into the crisis, they responded very well. So as we look at our businesses, and Warren touched on this, our large businesses, our mid-sized businesses, and even as you go down from there, they're in very sound shape as we go through the pandemic and are really preparing to emerge now. So they're evaluating. Listen, they're going to have a different customer. There's going to be different consumer behaviors. How our employees work, i.e. a lot of them work at home now. Does that make sense? And the communities we're operating in have all changed, but we're literally moving from the point of, okay, we're making it through the crisis and really planning to reemerge now. And I would say our businesses are in an extremely sound place.
We don't know when the...
This next question.
Well, I was just going to say, we don't know how long this period lasts, and nobody knows. You know, we don't know whether most people think, and they know more about it than I do, that the virus will, you know, to some extent, decline in its spread during summer months, and I would say a good many think that it will come back at some later date. And how the American public reacts if they get their hopes up through some reopening, through some summer diminution, and how they would react to a second attack in effect by the virus. It's like Dr. Fauci, you know, the virus is going to determine our behavior. You know, we we're doing a lot of smart things, and we've got a lot of very smart people, but there are unknowns, and the unknowns that apply to the health aspect create unknowns in the economy. And we'll have to keep evaluating things as we go along. Mm-hmm. I hope, like crazy, obviously, that once suppressed, that it doesn't come back, and that we readjust. But things don't always work perfectly. That doesn't mean there was a better course of action. I would not go around criticizing people at all for what they've done or anything of the sort. I just think you're dealing with a huge unknown, and I think that the degree to which it's disturbed the world and changed habits and endangered businesses in the last couple of months indicates that you better not be too sure of yourself about what it'll do in the next 6 months or year or whatever.
Well, Warren, a moment ago, you mentioned that you still are recommending that people invest in an S&P 500 index fund. Let me ask this question that came in from Kevin. He says, the last few weeks, we've been hearing from active money managers that the day of passive investing is over. The historical safety of investing in an index fund long term is gone. Would you please provide your thoughts on this topic, particularly in regards to an investment time span of 10 years?
Well, I can tell you, I haven't changed my will, and it directs that my widow would have 90% of the funds in index funds, and I think it's better advice than people are generally getting from people that are getting paid a lot to give other advice. You don't make a lot of money advising an S&P 500 index fund. I mean, and how you can say the day of index funds is over? I mean, if you say the day of investing in America is over, I would disagree quite violently. And then is there something special about index funds being a terrible way to invest? I just don't think, really, it's very hard to have evidence of that. I mean, if the index funds reflect the market, and one side has high fees that think they can pick out stocks, and the other side has low fees, I know which side's going to win over time. And you have to recognize that it's in a great many people's interest to convince you that they can do something that they may well even believe they can. And a certain percentage of them will do it from luck, and a few people will do it from skill. And that's what makes it so enticing that you can find the Jim Simons or somebody that's going to produce extraordinary return. Jim and his group have done it by brain power, but it's very unusual. And incidentally, they're going to charge you a lot of money, and they're going to actually maybe close up their fund if they do it, because they can't do it with really huge amounts of money compared to how the record's been established in the past. So you just have to recognize you're dealing with an industry where it pays to be a great salesperson, and it pays even better if you're a great salesperson and you can actually produce something. But the money is in selling. There's a lot more money in selling than in managing, actually, if you look to the essence of investment management.
I got a number of variations on this next question, some more polite than others. This one's right about down the middle. But this is from Mark Blakely, who writes in from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he says, like many, I'm a proud Berkshire Hathaway shareholder. However, in comparing the performance of Berkshire with the S&P 500 over the last 5, 10, or 15 years, I've been disappointed in Berkshire's underperformance. Even year to date, Berkshire is trailing the S&P 500 by 8%. To what would you attribute Berkshire's underperformance? Well, I can't imagine ever selling my Berkshire stock. At some point, money is money.
Well, I agree with everything that, I forget his name, but said. I mean, the truth is that I recommend the S&P 500 to people, and I happen to believe that Berkshire is about as sound as any single investment can be. In terms of earning reasonable returns over time, but I would not want to bet my life on whether we beat the S&P 500 over the next 10 years. I think I obviously think there's a reasonable chance of doing it, and we've had periods, I don't know how many out of the 55 years we've been doing it, I don't know how many we've beaten or not. I mentioned earlier that 1954 was my best year, but I was working with peanuts, unfortunately. And I think if you work with small sums of money, I think there is some chance of a few of people that really do bring something to the game. But I think it's very, very hard for anybody to identify them. And I think that when they work with large funds, it gets tougher. It's certainly gotten tougher for us with larger funds, and I would make no promise to anybody that we will do better than the S&P 500, but what I will promise them is that I've got 99% of my money in Berkshire, and most members of my family are may not be quite that extreme, but they're close to it. And I do care about what happens to Berkshire over the long period about as much as anybody could care about it. But caring doesn't guarantee results. It does guarantee attention. But, Greg?
Well, I would agree, Warren, that there's never guarantees, but when I look at the assets we have in place and the teams that are in place, i.e., you're committed to Berkshire, but we have dedicated teams that equally are dedicated to Berkshire, and they're sure going to give it their best effort every day. And when I look at the assets and the people, I think we have, you can't guarantee it, but we have a great chance of sure giving a good effort to outperform it.
It's hard to imagine getting a terrible result with Berkshire, but anything can happen. And what I do know is it would be easier to be running 5 million than our book net worth at Berkshire at the quarter end, I think, was 370 some billion, which is down, but it's still greater than the book net worth of any corporation in the United States. That's maybe there's some federal corporation that has more, but in terms of it may be the greatest in the world. I'm not sure.
When I would
and that,
add,
that makes life difficult in some ways too.
Right, and the potential of our operating businesses are substantial. When you think we've talked about energy, you touched on it that infrastructure is continuing to change. We're ready for $100 billion of investment opportunities there. If we just look at the business over the next 10 years and the infrastructure that's required and how it's changing, substantial investments there that just tell me we have very good prospects. And we're well positioned to pursue them, which again, to me, when you look at our core businesses, you touched on them, Burlington, the insurance and energy. It's our downside is very nicely protected. We have three really core great businesses.
Yeah, and we're better positioned than anybody in the energy business. Just because we don't have dividend requirements, we've retained $28 billion of earnings over 20 years. That you can't do it if you run a normal public company. And we've got a huge appetite, and the country needs it. The world needs it. And we are a very, very logical, well-structured, well-managed, I would say, because it doesn't involve me, company to participate in just huge requirements around the world. Now, they're slow and they involve governments and state governments. And there's a lot of, it's not anything that happens dramatically. It will happen, and Berkshire should participate in a huge way. We can do things in insurance nobody else can do. That doesn't mean much many times, but occasionally it may be important. So there are some advantages to size and strength, but there are disadvantages to size too. If we find some great opportunity that for $1 billion to double our money, that's $1 billion pre-tax, and that's $790 million after tax, and on a market value of $450 billion or whatever it may be, it doesn't amount to much, unfortunately. We'll still try and do it if we can.
Yeah.
Hey, Warren. I want to ask this question that came in because I think some people may have had a misinterpretation about something you said a few minutes ago. This is the benefit of being able to get these questions real time. But a few moments ago, you were talking about the people at the company who will be allocating capital after you and Charlie are no longer doing it. And you mentioned that you've got Todd, Ted, and Greg all doing that. But I've gotten a few questions that read similar to this. This one's from Edward Papula in New York City, who says, "Dear Warren, I noticed you didn't mention Ajit Jain when you reeled off your list of future management. Is he out of the picture?"
Well, Ajit is not in the capital allocation business. He is the best. Well, he's got one of the best minds in the world. I mean, I wrote his father after he worked for us for a few years. I wrote him again the other day, but 20 years ago I wrote him and I said, if you've got another son like this, send him over from India because we'll own the world then. Now, Ajit is one of a kind. Anybody will tell you that's had any contact with him, and particularly anybody in the insurance business where they know him well, he is absolutely one of a kind. But his job is not capital allocation. It's evaluating insurance risks. And that is a rare, he possesses a rare talent, and he has a huge capital backing to do it. So he's an incredible asset. But Greg and Todd and Ted have been in the asset allocation business in a big way for a long time. That's their game, and Ajit's game is insurance. So that's why I mentioned those three. And incidentally, while Charlie and I are around, we kind of like capital allocation ourselves. So we're not going anyplace voluntarily, but we probably will go someplace involuntarily before that long. Charlie's in good health, incidentally. I'm in good health.
Greg, let me ask you one of these capital allocation questions. This one comes from Matt Leibel. And he says, Berkshire directed 46% of capital expenditure in 2019 to Berkshire Hathaway Energy. Can you walk us through with round numbers how you think differences in CapEx spending versus economic depreciation versus GAAP depreciation and help explain the time frame over which we should recognize the contracted return on equity from these large investments as we are shareholders are making in Berkshire Hathaway Energy?
Right. So when we look at Berkshire Hathaway Energy and their capital programs, we try to really look at it as it was highlighted, really in a couple different packages. One, what does it actually require to maintain the existing assets for the next 10, 20, 30 years? I.e., it's not incremental, it's effectively maintaining the asset, the reflection of depreciation. And our goal is always to clearly understand across our businesses, do we have businesses that require more than our depreciation or equal or less? And happy to say with the assets we have in place and how we've maintained the energy assets, we generally look at our depreciation as being more than adequate if we deploy it back into capital to maintain the asset. Now, the unique thing in the lion's share of our energy businesses that are regulated, and that exceeds 85% of them, 83% of them, we still earn on that capital we deploy back into that business. So it's not a traditional model where you're putting it in, but you're effectively putting it in to maintain your existing earnings stream. So it's not drastically different, but we do earn on that capital. But what we do spend a lot of time, and that's what, when Warren and I think about the substantial amounts of opportunities, that's incremental capital that is truly needed within new opportunities. So it's to build incremental wind, incremental transmission that services the wind or other types of renewable solar. That's all incremental to the business and drives incremental both growth in the business. It does require capital, but it does drive growth within the energy business. So there's really the two buckets. I think we would use a number a little bit lower than the depreciation. We're comfortable the business can be maintained at that level. And as we deploy amounts above that, we really do view that as, quote, incremental or growth CapEx.
Yeah, we have what, $40 billion or something? What do we have in sort of kind of in the works?
Oh, yeah. So we have basically, as Warren's highlighting, $40 billion in the works of capital. That's over the next effectively 9 years, 10-year period. Approximately half of that we would view as maintaining our assets. A little more than half of it's truly incremental, but those are known projects we're going to move forward with. And I would be happy to report we probably have another $30 billion that aren't far off of becoming real opportunities in that business. Now, as Warren said, that takes a lot of time, it's a lot of work. The transmission projects, for example, we're finishing in 2020. Were initiated in 2008 when we bought Pacific Corp. I remember working on that transmission plan, putting it together, thinking 6 to 8 years from now we'll have them in operation. 12 years later, and over that period of time, we earn on that capital we have invested, and then when it comes into service, we earn on the whole amount. So we're very pleased with the opportunity, but we plant a lot of seeds. put it that way.
Yeah, and these are not, it's not like they're super high return thing, but they're decent returns over time. We're almost uniquely situated to deploy the capital you could have government entities do it too, but in terms of the private enterprise, and they take a long time. They earn decent returns. I've always said about the energy business, it's not a way to get real rich, but it's a way to stay real rich. And we will deploy a lot of money at decent returns, not super returns. And you shouldn't earn super returns on that sort of thing. I mean, it does. You are getting rights to do certain things that governmental authorities are authorizing, and they should protect consumers, but they also should protect people to put up the capital. It's worked now for 20 years, and it's got a long runway ahead.
All right, this next question comes from Jason in New Jersey. As both a Berkshire and Occidental shareholder, I was encouraged to see your investment in the company. But with passing weeks, it became evident that your investment facilitated Occidental management's ability to avoid a shareholder vote on the Anadarko acquisition, a very shareholder-unfriendly outcome. This deal proved to be irresponsible and expensive from an Oxy perspective, and ultimately very value-destructive for Oxy shareholders. In my view, it also permanently hurt Berkshire's reputation in the marketplace. Please comment on this unfortunate outcome and tell me why Oxy shareholders and other market observers shouldn't feel this way.
Well, we said right from the beginning, although we didn't certainly expect to agree to it, what's happened. We said essentially when you buy into an oil, a huge oil production company, how it works out is going to depend on the price of oil to a great extent. It's not going to be your geological home runs or super mistakes or anything like that. It is a investment that depends on the price of oil. And when oil goes to -$37, it happened the other day for I guess it was the May contract. That's off the chart, and if you own oil, you should only own oil if you expect these prices to go up significantly. I don't know whether they'll go up significantly or not. We're in the transaction. Our commitment was made on a Sunday when the management of Anadarko favored Chevron. And Chevron had a breakup fee of $1 billion, and Occidental people have been working on it for several years. And it was attractive at oil prices that then prevailed. And it doesn't work, obviously. It doesn't work at $20 a barrel. Certainly doesn't work in -$37 a barrel, but it doesn't work at $20 a barrel. And everything the oil companies have been doing, whether it's Exxon or Occidental or anybody else, it doesn't work at these oil prices. That's why oil production is going to go down a lot in the next few years, because it does not pay to drill. Now, that's happened at other times in the past, but the situation is... you don't know where you're going to store the incremental barrel of oil, and oil demand is down dramatically. And for a while, the Russians and the Saudis were trying to outdo each other in how much oil they could produce. And when you've got too much in storage, it doesn't work its way off that very fast. Now, you will have production of oil go down in the United States significantly. It does not pay to drill in all kinds of formations that it paid before, and it doesn't pay to have paid the price that oil was trading at in the ground a year or two ago. And to that extent, if you're an Oxy shareholder, you've or any shareholder in any oil producing company, you join me in having made a mistake so far in terms of where oil prices went, and who knows where they go in the future.
Let me follow up with this one then. This one comes in from Manish Bal, who says, is there a risk of permanent loss of capital in the oil?
Thanks for listening to this section of the Berkshire Hathaway's annual Shareholders Meeting podcast. The next section can be found in the next episode in your podcast feed. Please go check it out. If you enjoy this podcast, leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.